Marty Moss Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. When you think about it, we spend a good portion of our day in negotiations, whether it's getting kids to go to bed, addressing a problem at work, making a financial transaction, dealing with everyday challenges and opportunities. Our guest, Stuart Diamond, has spent much of his life as a professional negotiator, and he's found that qualities like empathy, patience, and authenticity, rather than power plays and arm twisting, are keys to successful negotiations. That's what he's taught at a popular course at Wharton Business School. It's also what he writes in his new book called Getting More, and he describes and deconstructs some of the techniques and skills that have served him and others. And Stuart Diamond is a professor at the Wharton Business School, also at the Penn Law School. He's been a consultant, advised Fortune 500 companies, the UN, the World Bank. He also helped to negotiate the end of the Hollywood writer's strike, and he was a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the New York Times. And Stuart Diamond joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
So what's wrong with power plays and arm twisting?
They cause resentment and retaliation, and they're the stock and trade of negotiations people have learned since they were small, and they get about one quarter of the value of doing it another way. I've taught 30,000 people in 45 countries, and most of the instructions people have to negotiate are wrong.
And why do they persist?
Because they don't know any better.
Because they don't
know people don't know any better. Period. End of story. I've got students that have gotten magnificent raises, companies that have made $1 billion, parents that have got their kids willing to go to bed just by doing it a different way, which means that learning about their perceptions and valuing their perceptions, their emotions, the pictures in their head is more important than any collection of power, win-win, threats, my way or the highway, good cop, bad cop, that you can possibly muster in a negotiation.
I was thinking about what negotiation is about, and it seems on the one hand it is about persuasion, and it's also about problem solving. Is that how you see it?
Problem solving and meeting your goals. Meeting your goals over all relevant time frames, which means in order for me to meet my goals, I've got to meet your needs over all relevant time frames. So if I'm short time at this and you're going to be mad at me tomorrow, I probably haven't met my goals.
You talk about perception, and I guess that is really understanding the person that you are negotiating with, how they see the world. Yeah.
Yes, and most of these tools are invisible. Let me give you a couple of really simple examples.
Go ahead.
I had a former student flew up to Philly from Houston a couple of weeks ago. Plane was 4 hours late. The rest of the passengers were snarling at the flight attendants. This former student of mine went up to the flight attendants, apologized for everybody's behavior, and commiserated with them for having to work 4 hours longer that day. And when he got off the plane, they gave him $600.
You mean that?
Yes, absolutely. Only one on the plane to get that because he tapped into the pictures in their heads. It wasn't their fault they were late, and he made a connection. Studies show that when you make a human connection with somebody, they are 6 times more likely to give you what you want, which means 90% versus 16%. And so most people just don't do that. You see, we live in a world where conflict is the model.
Empathy is, it sounds like you're describing both empathy and his willingness to sort of look outside of his own experience.
Right. We live in an emotional world, and the more important the negotiation is, the more emotional the parties are, whether it's world peace, a $1 billion deal, or my kid wants an ice cream cone. So when people are emotional, they don't want to hear from win-win. They don't want to hear from logical arguments. Mm-hmm. They want an apology, a concession. The school district raises your taxes. I don't want to know from win-win. I want to know, what are you going to do to make my life feel better? And until you do that, I'm not even listening to you.
If he hadn't gotten $600, would that still have been a good negotiation on his part?
Well, he wanted some compensation for his effort. That was his goal. Right. And maybe he would have gotten $400. Maybe he would have gotten a free ticket. What he got in addition to the $600 is a lot of goodwill from those people. Now they know his name. Now he knows their name. So that negotiation will last beyond that incident. Let me talk for a moment, if I may, about the writer's strike, because this is what everybody knows about.
Sure.
I got a call in 2008 from Ari Emanuel, who is a top agent in Hollywood. He's a role model for Entourage and the brother of Rahm, who was the White House chief of staff. They wanted some help. The writers had been on strike for 3 months, no contract for a year. And they wanted advice on substantive issues like royalties, etc. I said, forget those issues. Go to see the studio heads and ask them 3 questions. 1, are you guys happy? We're not happy. Question number 2, you guys making any money? We're not making any money. Question number 3, if you had to do this over again, how would you do it? It took 30 minutes to restart the negotiations. It took 2 days to get a deal. I can say 2 things about this. 1, it's not rocket science. And 2, unless you already know how to do it, it's invisible. Making that connection, whether they like you, whether they hate you, the right answer to the statement, I hate you, is tell me more. Because I want to get...
Rather than I hate you.
Right, or anything else, because I want the pictures in your head. Unless I have them, I have no idea even where to start.
And you're talking about a strike that went on for a long time. Is it also an example of people sort of doing the same thing over and over again, getting the same results, but expecting something different?
Yes, if you continue to cook with lousy tools and lousy ingredients, you're going to keep eating lousy dinners, no matter how much you want to cook good dinners. You don't have the skills because you haven't been taught. Let me bring up something which is really common today, civility. There's been a lot of talk on civility.
Yes.
Americans don't know how to be civil. So we can say smile all you want. To be civil, you don't have to smile just at somebody. You have to really commiserate with them and act like you care about them. And that's a whole other skill set.
Act like? Is that as good as actually caring about the other person?
I misspoke. I meant really caring about other people, because that's the way to get what you want. And it works in every kind of situation. If the more I find out about the other party, the more I can add to the deal. The CEO of a major company in Philly once told me the most important thing he ever did for a business client in a 20-year business relationship was to pick up the client's CEO's mother-in-law at the Philadelphia airport one Saturday night. Has nothing to do with any deal, but it affects every deal. That was a tremendous business decision. And so really what Getting More does is it brings people outside the four corners of the deal and says you're negotiating with a person with their whole set of needs and synapses. And if you do that, you never have a commodity product because you're always in the deal.
Does that, though, assume that the person that you're negotiating with also is negotiating in good faith?
No. If they're not negotiating in good faith, I'll say, how come you're not negotiating in good faith?
Mm-hmm.
Or how come you're not, I don't feel you're being nice to me. Good negotiators have a firm grasp of the obvious. And so if we're not getting along, I want to say, we're not getting along.
State the obvious.
Yes. And if somebody looks like they're annoyed with me, I'll say, you're annoyed with me. Because if people are angry and uncertain, they physiologically hear less. And the first thing I've got to do is get them ready to negotiate with me, which they can't if they're not listening.
Do you have to like the person
no,
that you're negotiating
you can
with?
Hate them. We should have negotiated with Saddam Hussein. Whatever I think of my enemy, I'd sure like to know what the contents of his head are. And I get information from the negotiation. So even if my decision is to bomb the heck out of them, I'd sure like to know more information. And so this notion of walking out, not talking, it's just a stupid way to negotiate.
So you're saying stay at the table, deal with what's going on?
Get as much information as you can. And if somebody says it's a sign of weakness, why is it a sign of weakness? I don't feel weak. You want to call me weak? Call me weak all day long. I'm showing up to get information from you. So it's just a different way of looking at the process of human interaction.
You also talk about style. And you have a certain style, so do I.
Right.
That style, tone, I mean, some of these sort of intangibles also can affect negotiation.
Very, very important. The question, who's the right negotiator, needs to be answered this way. Is the person most likely to get the other party to give me what I want? Which means that probably the best negotiator on your business team is the weakest member of that team. When you have a lot of power, when you have a lot of expertise, studies show that you care less about the other party. When you have less power, you tend to care more about the other party. And so the experts are generally the wrong negotiators, which you have in the Middle East, which you have in healthcare. You need people to make a connection with each other. They should have had people on the ground in the Middle East have lunch for 2 years. I mean, there's already peace in the Middle East. There's hundreds of thousands of Israelis and Palestinians live together in Israel. They should be negotiating.
You mentioned the fact that you were involved in a negotiation and you decided not to be at the table. This was a company that was headquartered in the South, and you
right.
felt as if your style just wasn't going to get the
That's
results
right.
that you were looking for.
It was
for.
A medical services company that did laser eye surgery early in the process. The investors from the Deep South and everybody in the company, I was the only Northerner, and everybody knew that whatever I said in that negotiation, they would look at me and think of me as that aggressive guy from the Northeast. Now, I wanted to change their opinion of me. Our goal was to get their money. So somebody from Georgia did the negotiation, mm-hmm. and I advised them offline.
You also talk about making emotional payments and also talking about the sort of uneven emotional, the willingness to do something to right. help that person across the table.
A concession, an apology, I understand. If you don't do that, people mm-hmm. tend to get angry and they don't help. Here's a perfect example.
Okay.
A lot's been said recently about going into brick-and-mortar stores, checking your cell phone, seeing the internet cheaper, and threatening to walk out. All that does is get the other side angry at you, and they don't care if you walk out because you're threatening their job. Instead, you should be saying, you know, we have a problem. I want to buy from you, but your price is too expensive. What do we do? And you'll find you get an employee discount, you get a free service agreement, you get a free warranty, they'll give you a better advice on appliances. And so that's a way of not threatening somebody and getting more from doing that. So looking, just I should mention one other point close to home, if I may.
Okay.
This is very dear to my heart. I told my class at Wharton that I tell my wife she's right, even when she's not, to preserve marital harmony. And then I thought, that's not fair. My wife doesn't know that. So I went home and I
now
said...
Now she does.
I went home and I said, honey, you know, I told my class today that I tell you you're right even when you're not to preserve marital harmony. And you know what she said?
What?
That'll work. The urge to get emotional payments is huge among people, to be valued by others. And that's one of the first orders of businesses.
Is that why a genuine, true apology can be so healing?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, and we're not talking about just going through the motions, but actually apologizing
right.
for something
right.
that you've done.
Our over-lawyered society says apology means admitting liability. Doesn't have to be. I'm sorry for what happened here. I'm sorry for any part I had in this. I really wish things were better. There's lots of ways to value the other party without admitting liability, and you got to actually take the effort to do it right. or you'll get less.
But why do you think that's so hard?
It's not hard. It's just no skill. You know, once you see this stuff, you always see it. Until then, it's just not there at all. And so what I've tried to do with my students is to show them a structure, and I make them go out and practice. Another invisible strategy. You go into a store in Philadelphia.
Right.
You wear something you bought there. You carry something you bought there. Now you're a loyal customer without having to say a word. You've negotiated silently, and when you ask for a discount, it's much more effective than saying, if you don't give me a discount on the shirt, I'm going somewhere else. And so that's what I mean about things, small, subtle changes that give you a lot more.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And Stuart Diamond is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at the Wharton Business School, also a professor at Penn Law School, and he's written a new book. It's what we're talking about. It's called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Stuart Diamond says things like emotions, feelings, perceptions have a lot more to do with effective negotiations than throwing your weight around and arm twisting and power plays. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Tennis Channel, now presenting extensive HD coverage of the 2011 Australian Open, including live primetime matches nightly. A complete schedule and more information are available at tennischannel.com.
Hello, I am Jerome Perrivert, President and CEO of Dow Advanced Materials. Join Dow in partnership with the Chemical Heritage Foundation in celebrating the International Year of Chemistry 2011. Find information about programs on issues facing the world and how molecular science is poised to address them at chemheritage.org/IYC2011. CHF supports WHYY.
25 years ago, Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau started aging his characters in real time.
It's no easier to make them truly old than it is to look in the mirror and see yourself aging. Every time I add white hair, it's actually a big deal for me.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
supporting WHYY, PNC Arts Alive, a five-year, $5 million program of the PNC Foundation, supporting innovative arts programming with the goal of making the arts accessible to all. More at PNCArtsAlive.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. According to our guest, Stuart Diamond, we spend much of our lives in some form of negotiation, and frankly, we're not very good at it. And he says, if you want to be more effective, think about things like perceptions and feelings. And that's what he writes about in his new book called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. You had said earlier about win-win. What's wrong? Isn't win-win the goal of any negotiation?
There's lots of things wrong with it. First of all, it's a rational tool in an irrational world.
It's a rational tool.
In a world that's irrational. And so most people, as I said earlier, don't care about win-win. They want to get their emotional needs met. The second thing is I might want to lose today to win tomorrow. The third thing, it doesn't tell me what to do. And what does win-win mean? The correct dynamic is trade items of unequal value so each party benefits, which means I give you something you value, you give me that I don't value very much, and vice versa. That tells me what to do. Win-win doesn't tell me what to do, and frankly, win-win sounds a little manipulative. You know, an investment banker in London once said, we all say we do win-win, but nobody does it anyway. You know, it's a little manipulative.
Well, it's better than win-lose, though, isn't it?
It depends on what my goals are. Again,
you might be willing to lose something to hopefully...
Right. So it's very amorphous. Trading items of equal value is much better.
Well, and explain what you mean by that. And I have to say, I underscored that in the book because it felt a little counterintuitive.
Okay, good example. I had a guy from Google, wanted to get a multimillion-dollar account, couldn't get it. Talked to the guy, found out the guy's interest in family life, found out the guy's daughter had computer problems, invested half a Saturday, went over to the guy's house, tutored the daughter, fixed the computer, got the multimillion-dollar account. That's trading items of an equal value. The Google guy invested half a day, he got a multimillion-dollar account. And so looking at the things they need that I can trade, this works great with kids. I have an 8-year-old son, Alexander, and I know that kids, like all kids, he has no power. He wants power. So I try to let him pick the restaurants. His room can be a little dirty sometimes. He can, go to bed a little later. And you know what happens? He's in a constant debtor situation with me. He always owes me stuff. And then when I say, Daddy wants you to be safe, Daddy wants you to take a bath, he does it for me. That's trading items of unequal value. You can do this. There's a million conversations throughout this region where this goes on every day.
But isn't that manipulating your kid?
I tend to define manipulation as something that hurts the other party, not something that gets the other party to do something else. And so as long as I'm not hurting people, then I'm actually manipulating them, if you want to use that word, into doing something which benefits them more. What's wrong with that?
Well, nothing, I don't think, on the face of it. But I guess it's sort of it doesn't take into account, I guess, the relationship. But maybe it's another way of thinking about that relationship.
I tell Alexander I do this. He's cool with it. He gets his needs met. And so, and that's also true. You know, I come home from school, from work, he's watching TV again.
Right.
Instead of just turning off the TV, I think, you know, I come home from work, I'm stressed up, maybe I have a drink. Maybe the kid had a bad day at elementary school. Maybe he needs to chill out. And so I want to say to him, you need to chill out. You have a bad day at elementary school, and so maybe he needs some TV to chill out. Even if I'm wrong, he appreciates the fact that I've given respect, and people pay you for that. Maitre d's at restaurants pay you for respect. Bureaucrats pay you for respect. Those are intangibles you can trade.
Well, I'm thinking that the kids, whether they can verbalize it or not, know their parents very well. I mean, and that's sort of part of what you say negotiation is about, because I think kids can be very good, very skilled negotiators because they know who they're dealing with.
But then you want them to know who they're dealing with. My kid wouldn't do his homework a couple months ago. It was 7:30 at night. He said, how about 8:30? My wife went ballistic. I said, how about 7:33? He said, okay. My wife said, what's going on here? What's going on here is kids are incremental. Can I have a cookie? Can I have a half cookie? Can I have a quarter of a cookie? I essentially told him I understood incremental, and he gave me a 57-minute concession. And so you want to show kids that you understand their language, and you'll get it back many times over.
And it's incremental, another way to also think about negotiations, not even beyond children?
Oh, you bet. One of the big problems with negotiations in the world, in a risky world, is people take steps that are too big. If we had started with one healthcare clinic 30 years ago or 100 years ago, we'd have a healthcare plan. If we started with one factory in the Middle East 30 years ago, we'd have Middle East peace. The technology industry has learned about starting small and scaling up, and it's the most profitable industry in the United States. You can't solve a plan with, you know, 1,000 constituents and 2,000 issues. You need to do this incrementally.
But we live in a, you know, whether we like it or not, or whether we've created it or not, a very complicated world. I mean, not all things, it seemed to me, can be reduced to some simple elements.
That's exactly right. The name of my book is Getting More, Not Getting Everything.
Right.
So these things do not work all the time, but they work much more than if you don't use them. And a lot of complicated subjects are amenable to be broken down if you just make it less complicated. I've got a problem-solving model which breaks things down to their essential, simple elements and solves them one at a time.
Well, since we're in the throes of negotiating healthcare once again, I mean, using that as an example, how would you, I guess, break it down into component parts and even find some kind of consensus,
right,
or some kind of negotiated, right, consensus on this issue?
Before her husband was elected president, Michelle Obama ran a clinic in the center of Chicago for the indigent without health insurance. That's a pretty good model to deal with people without health insurance. It's not expensive. You use residents and interns supervised by doctors in the local community. It's something that's controllable locally. You don't need a big bill. It doesn't solve all healthcare problems. But you know what it does? It brings people along the path so they can actually see something tangible getting done. The problem with big solutions is people don't see any progress. Mm. I've talked to both sides in the abortion debate who say there hasn't been any improvement in 40 years. What if the solution was, can we have one less abortion this year than last year? Abortion went up this year. And so the goals are too big. You've got to short in your company, can I have a trial? Can I try this more simply?
Hmm.
You know, people instinctively know this, but they don't carry it out.
But using the idea of a free clinic staffed by physicians or medical school students for the uninsured, that should have been what was negotiated last year?
I'm not suggesting a specific policy because I'm not an expert in the healthcare field. I'm an expert in process.
Right.
But the question is, the point is, the process they have is wrong. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It doesn't work. Incremental solutions work. And so I don't see much effort talking about what can we do as a model, as a test that we could replicate.
Sounds like, not just for your model, but for others, is that patience is really required in the negotiation process because you're dealing with another human being.
Right. Well, I believe one of your previous callers said that this healthcare problem started 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have taken us 100 years. I first suggested a factory in the Middle East 30 years ago. You know, you got to start somewhere, and it takes a heck of a lot less than if you try to do everything at once.
Well, let's take on the Middle East. You know, a very intractable problem there. You've got two sides that are sort of dug in. There are talks about talks.
It's not intractable.
There's a whole history there that's involved. You've got two groups of people that feel like they are victims. How do you deal with that?
First of all, it's not two groups of people who feel like they're victims. It's hundreds of thousands of different people. There are peace groups all over the Middle East with Arabs and Jews in them. There are models that you can replicate. The parties on both sides, first of all, should be having lunch for 2 years and talking about soccer or something else. They'd be much farther along than they are now. Second of all, what you want to do is you want to start, as I said, small, and you want to focus on the goal. The goal is a Palestinian state. So settlements, there's land to swap. It's a useless argument. They don't need to talk about it. Capital in East Jerusalem, the Vatican runs a whole Catholic religion from less than one square mile in Rome. Do they need more than that in East Jerusalem? And so every time somebody says something, the Palestinians should say, where's my state?
Hmm.
Now, that would be focused on goals. Everything else is emotion.
Well, and just picking up on that, then I do want to get to our callers, because I think even in less heated negotiations, it's easy to lose track of what the goal is,
oh,
because you
bet.
Get upset. You get angry, you get derailed.
And that's the problem. That's one of the big problems. You either have to take a break, find another negotiator, or lower your expectations. Because dashed expectations are a big part of emotion. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons people have emotion about Obama is their expectations were too high. So when I go into a negotiation, I tend to have very low expectations. I'm never disappointed. I'm often pleasantly surprised.
And you talk about, I mean, that even in your conversation, it's all about meeting some basic goals as opposed to loftier ones.
I want to start with the easy things, and I want to do it one step at a time. My son won't clean his room. Will he clean a quarter of his room? And so I want to keep shortening the amount I have to accomplish, and it makes me have enough confidence to go farther.
And that's Stuart Diamond, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about negotiation, something that he has done both professionally and also as a professor at the Wharton Business School, teaches a very popular class on negotiation. And he's also written a book based on his experiences and his philosophy called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. And just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Let me get some callers in, and we've got Mike from Springfield on Radio Times. And Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Stuart, Marty, thank you for taking my call.
You're
Can
welcome.
You hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. Stuart, I'm in the food business. I actually have a meeting tomorrow in Boston with a national account, a food service account. We've done business with them probably for about 8 years. I've managed it for the last 6. I need to negotiate a price increase on what some might consider a commodity product that they've used for some time, but they're telling me that they're absolutely refusing any price increases due to the state of the economy.
And Mike, very quickly, what is the commodity that you're negotiating about?
It's cheese.
It's cheese. Okay, no, just fair enough. Well, let me see what he has to say.
A couple of things. First is, what is it that you could give them that they value that could cause them to pay a higher price? What do they like most about their competitors or your competitors? What do they like least about you? What can you change on their behalf to give them more value?
And would you say to be as overt as that?
Very overt. Second, what can they give you that they value? Maybe they've got referrals for you that could cause you to hold the price. For example, if someone gives me a lot of extra business and referrals, I might keep the price the same. But I want to get into a discussion of what else is there in this deal, because the way we have just on money, there isn't sufficient value in the deal to go forward.
And the idea is to be that direct, I guess, and
yes.
That he needs to say, look, we're at an impasse here. What can we do to help each other?
Well, let me ask, Mike, what do you think about this? It's your business. How does that sound to you?
What do you think, Mike?
I like it. This is only the second time we've looked to raise our price in the 6 years that I've done business with him.
The first time
I was able to negotiate a price increase.
Right. Another thing,
I think I used all my bullets on that one.
Okay,
well, another
enough.
Thing you might want to do is when I go for a raise at the University of Pennsylvania, I always tell the deans whether I should be paid less this year than last year, because if the CPI goes up and I get paid the same, I'm paid less. Is my work any less valuable this year than last year? And I want to get into a discussion about value. I've got increased costs too. Maybe a big company can help me save money. Maybe they can help me cut my costs in some way. They're a larger company. They've got advice for me. I want to ask them that also.
Mike, thanks for the call. So do you get a raise from your boss at Penn?
I get
a Penn?
Yes, and the Penn Law School Dean says every year, I can't wait for the CPI to go down.
Just to get revenge
on
you, right? Exactly. Let me get Raymond from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Raymond, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. How do you get outside of your head or your thoughts in order to see what type of business decisions that you're making that are getting the response that you want? I'm a photographer here in Philadelphia,
right.
And for the past 2 years, myself and my business partner have been trying to market a particular image I captured of a politician, and we just have been not able to get far with it at all.
Well, Raymond, yeah, I appreciate the call, and we're losing your phone there a little bit.
A few things come to mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
Try to put yourself in the shoes of the other party and think what they think. If you don't,
how do you do that? Because that was his first question. How do you get outside your own head?
What you need to do is you need to actually do that. If I were the other side, what would I think? Mm-hmm. And have your spouse or your friend play you. Actually do
like role
a
play?
We do a role play all the time. Second, ask them. Third, if they won't tell you, you guess. If you guess right, they'll be happy. If you guess wrong, they'll tell you what the answer is. So those are at least three things I want to do to find out what the other side is thinking to get an idea of value. I also want to say, someone once said, I want $100,000 from you. And I said, why not $200,000? And they said, what? I said, we haven't talked about what's in the deal yet. What about cross-selling? What about referrals? And so someone says, what's your position? I say, I have no idea what's in the deal. So I want to know first what's in the deal, and that means our entire lives are open for discussion, from computers to tennis to travel to all the people we've ever met. And the people who are better at this, as I said, get four times as much as the people who don't do it.
Raymond, good luck, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Katie from Conshohocken has to say. And Katie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Great program.
Thanks.
I guess my concern is a little more localized. It's not about Middle East peace. It's more about how do I go from being a teacher in an interview situation, from being one of the considered applicants to actually landing the position.
Great question.
Yeah.
I want to tell you a little story about Mehul Trivedi, who took my negotiation course because he got rejected by 18 firms. And I said, Mehul, we're going to go back to the same firms. He said, with respect, Professor Diamond, you're crazy. I said, let's see. What I want you to do is I want you to write 18 different resumes, not one resume. I want you to find out the needs and pictures in their heads of each department and each person that you're interviewing with, and write a specific resume just for each person and their department. He gave up after getting 12 final interviews and a fistful of job offers. He just took one and said, it's obvious I would have gotten the rest. I'm an employer. Once every 2 years do I get a resume that shows any effort on the part of the applicant to find out who I am and who my firm is. And so I want to be much more specific, targeting the resume to the individuals who are interviewing me.
And I know about you because I can Google you. I mean, are you saying that kind of research so that you can tailor?
Or ask them. I had Mehul talk to a Wharton alumni, former employees he found, human resources. And then finally in the first interviews, you ask them.
Hmm.
And so there's a lot of ways to get in or do role reversal. You know, I might be wrong, but it occurred to me that some of your needs are X. People say there's somebody making the effort. I want to hire this person.
Well, good luck to you, Katie, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. But it sounds like what you're saying, the bottom line is this, it's relational. I mean, it is about negotiating and trying to get something, but it's based on a relationship, even a temporary, short-term relationship you have with the person that you're talking to.
Even in transaction situations. Americans are not real good at relationships because we have a legal system that we can sue the guy or sue the person. Most of the rest of the world do not have a legal system that works. You get hosed by your partner in Bolivia, Yemen, or Mongolia. There's no welfare system or food stamps. You and your family may literally starve to death. So in the U.S., relationships are a very nice subject. People talk about it on radio and TV. In the rest of the world, it's a matter of life and death. So people really get to know each other well in other parts of the world a lot better than they do here. And so I suggest there's a really interesting strategy for clever hostage negotiators.
Hold on to that thought.
Okay, I will.
We're going to take a very sharp break. And that comment came from a lawyer and law professor, Stuart Diamond. He joined us today on Radio Times to talk about negotiation. He's been a negotiator for many, many years, working with Fortune 500 companies, the UN, the World Bank. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times and teaches here in the Philadelphia area. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Bristol Riverside Theater presents The Little Prince, January 25th through February 13th. Puppets by Emmy Award-winning puppet builders Monkey Boys of Avenue Q and Little Shop of Horrors bring this classic story to life. This tale for all ages begins as a pilot crashes in the Sahara Desert and a little boy appears asking him to draw a sheep. As absurd as it seems, the aviator takes out a scrap of paper and a pen, and they continue on an enchanting adventure. BRTstage.org or 215-785-0100.
On the next Fresh Air, Australian actress Jackie Weaver talks about playing the matriarch of a criminal family who has a twisted relationship with her boys.
It is an inappropriate gesture to kiss your adult son lingeringly on the mouth.
And we talk with David Michaud, who wrote the role for Weaver and directed the film Animal Kingdom. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Nearly 2 out of 3 cases of thyroid cancer occur in people between 20 and 55 years of age. Thyroid growths or nodules are most often non-cancerous but do require careful decisions in regard to their management. Fox Chase endocrinologists and surgeons provide personalized attention in determining the best course of action for each patient, including observation, biopsies, and surgical removal. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And again, our guest, Stuart Diamond, says that we're pretty terrible when it comes to negotiation. It's also something we spend a lot of our life doing. He says the most effective way of getting people to say yes is by dealing with their perceptions and their feelings. He teaches a popular course at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, has led negotiation courses in some 45 countries, and put all this practical experience and wisdom into a new book called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Real Goal, your Goals in the Real World. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You were talking about hostages.
That's right. Transactional relationships is a really clever strategy for hostage negotiators. When hostage takers send out for lunch, a hostage negotiator is never sending complete meals. They send in large loaves of bread, cheese, and ham. They send large bottles of condiments and drinks, hoping the hostage takers will make lunch with the hostages, making it harder, therefore, for the hostage takers to shoot the hostages. Huh. So the more, when you wave to people or catch eye contact from the merge lane in heavy traffic, it's that connection that gets you more, no matter who they are.
What about, and we were talking about this during the break, that there are certain people, certain situations that are not, you can't not, not everything is a negotiation.
That's exactly right. Negotiating with extremists and suicide bombers and people who have hurt my family physically are not items, as far as I'm concerned, for negotiation. But that doesn't mean that negotiation is impossible through third parties. I had a woman in one of my classes who was divorcing her husband because he physically abused her. They couldn't afford lawyers. He had a meeting with her and invited his best friend, who was more reasonable, who kept him calm and honest during the course of the discussion. So I'm looking around for third parties.
And speaking of terrorists, then you're saying that these are not people you can negotiate with, because you can't negotiate in good faith?
Yeah, well, they have different agendas. Right. Here's a fascinating, very little known story. And it's a story of Sri Lanka. 2 years ago, the Sri Lankan government offered blanket amnesty to the Tamil Tigers against political advice. Anybody who came back, you're free to go. A lot of people came back, including number two in the Tamil Tigers. Two things happened as a result. The problem got smaller since there were less rebels. The second and more interesting thing is the people who came back, they told the government where the other guys were. And the government went and got the other guys. I'm not suggesting that no military solution is necessary. What I am suggesting is that there are small, better ways to do it. That was a negotiated solution followed by a military solution. And that's a pretty good model for around the world.
Well, and it sounds like negotiating from strength, because one could also, I can imagine someone saying, oh, you know, you're giving in to terrorists or hostage takers.
Well, the U.S. is not the right negotiator in the Middle East. Yeah, we don't know the land, the territory. We should be negotiating with the moderates to get the extremists on both sides. Now, that is a good negotiation mantra. It's a series of concentric circles. If I can't negotiate with you because we have too much distance between us, I need intermediaries that are successively closer to you that will negotiate with you, whether it is around the corner or around the world.
Well, that's interesting. Let me get Steve from Philadelphia to join us. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. That would be number 7. And you're on Radio Times. There we go. Okay, Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
And Stuart. First, in full disclosure, I know Stuart. I went to business school with him. We got our MBA together.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Years ago, I was in a negotiation to acquire a company, and I found the most difficult type of person to negotiate with is one who wanted to hear the entire deal and wouldn't commit to deal points. So I just want to ask Stuart, how do you handle people like that?
The problem is they would never commit to something. I can't go any farther in the negotiation unless I have a process we both agree to. And so how do we deal with an agreement if there's not going to be a commitment?
Right.
And so I've got to start there. And I don't want to go any farther.
Do you walk away? I mean, you're saying don't. I mean,
I'm
there
not
must
saying
be
I
times
walk away. I want to know what's the process. How do we reach it? Are they want to look at a package at the end? So there's no commitment until the end. That may be. What's wrong with that, John?
Steve? Yeah.
Steve, sorry.
That's okay.
What's wrong with having a whole package at the end?
Well, nothing wrong with it, except I think it doesn't lend itself to a structured agreement. And, you know, I think the advantage is on his side, because if timing is on his side, then you sort of lose control of the negotiations.
Okay.
And is that what happened, Steve?
It is. I mean, eventually we reopened the deal several months later, but it was an agonizing process.
Right, so you need to present to him the problems you have, and you need to say, did you want to reach a deal with me? I've got certain needs. Do you think that I should be happy in this deal as well as you, or do you think this is one-sided? That's what I call standards. Ask them whether they want to be fair or they want to be unfair. And you'll find that a lot of people are not going to say, I want to be unfair.
Does that make sense, Steve?
It does. Thank you very much.
No, thanks for calling into Radio Times, which I think underscores something you say as well, Stuart Diamond, which is you have to be authentic, right? Or I don't know. Are you honest like the whole time? Do you withhold information?
I don't disclose my bank account if I don't feel it's appropriate. And I will say I'm not disclosing my bank account because it's not appropriate. I think that George Bush won the election in 2000 because people liked him more than the other guy. And I think the same thing is true with Obama in 2008. If they don't like you, they won't support you. They won't vote for you. And so first of all, they've got to trust you. They've got to like you. If I go into a negotiation, I'm really aggressive. I'm going to say, you know, I'm really aggressive. If I get over the top, just slap me around. It's very disarming. It takes the issue away. If I don't know another culture, I'm going to say, I apologize in advance. Please advise me.
This is who I am, right?
Yeah, advise me. I now have the freedom to be myself and to get an advisor, not an opponent. And so it's very transparent, the negotiation I propose.
And is it honest?
Absolutely.
I mean, everything is on the table?
Not everything. I'm not going to tell them again my bank account. I'm not going to. What you do is you release information that brings you closer to your goals, and you don't release information that brings you farther from your goals. Mm-hmm. And so I might not tell them how much I can spend in the beginning, mm-hmm. but if they want more than I can spend, I'll tell them at the end. To save the deal. And so each time I want to say, is this bringing me closer or farther from my goals?
All righty. Let me get Sarah from Chad's Ford to join our conversation. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had a question regarding today's economy. If you're trying to get a job, a lot of times if you're changing your field, you go into a new field at a little older age, like maybe mid-30s or late-30s and early-40s. And the most common problem I encounter is that, well, we just you don't have any experience, so we can't give you this job. But my question is, how do you gain experience unless you get the job?
Sure.
That's
well,
a
you
great,
know what I mean?
That's
a
great
exactly.
question, and
a
it actually
question.
Goes to the question of standards. Experience is only one indicator of what employers really want, which is skill to do the job. Mm-hmm. Some people have a lot of experience and are lousy. Some people have no experience and they're great. And so what you want to do is break down the job you're applying for into the skills required for that job and show them what skill set you have that's consistent with the job. That's a much more effective way to apply.
And the idea being that, you know, even using volunteer experiences or family experience to say, look, I know how to negotiate. I've got 7 children, something like that.
Whatever it is that you have. But just because you're in one area doesn't mean you're in another. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, there was a football player named Ralph Kemper. He never played a game of tennis, and I was captain of the tennis team. And he played me a game of tennis, and I beat him 6-4. I didn't want to play him again. Okay, he translated all his skills to another game instantly. It didn't matter how much experience he had.
Let me get Francis from Old City to join us on Radio Times. And Francis, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a question concerning a custody situation after a divorce. I'm trying to get more time to spend with my sons, and we've gone through a very nasty court battle. And we've had a parent coordinator, and the other side has left. And I'm wondering what it is that I can do to be able to work with my kids a bit more.
If it's rancorous, you're the wrong negotiator. Because every time you show up, it gets a whole bunch of emotions that arise. And so you need someone that will hear the other party out and frame for them what would benefit the kid. And you need to try something very incremental. Would one more minute with daddy doing X thing benefit the kid? Would five more minutes benefit? And so you need to have a whole plan to get from 1 minute to 4 hours, if that's your goal, over a period of time, step by step, and the other party does not want to seem unreasonable in front of third parties. And the more incremental you make the process, the more unreasonable they become if they don't say yes.
Well, that's interesting. But what you're also saying is frame it in terms of what the child.
Oh, right. This
gets,
is about the
in
kid.
Terms of Francis's particular situation.
You bet.
Because I think oftentimes in divorce, where there are children, if it's acrimonious, it's the parents fighting with each other, and the kids get kind of lost in the negotiation process.
Right. I mean, we've completely screwed up here. Should we screw the kid up too? I'm really big at asking questions. Good negotiators have a firm grasp of the obvious, and if you want to help other people see the vision, you want to say what's really going on here, and you want to frame it for the other party.
Mm. Good luck to you, Francis, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. We got Linda from Fairmount to join us. And Linda, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Yes.
Listen, this incremental negotiation sounds a lot like raising small children. Do women make better negotiators than men?
A really good question.
That's interesting.
It's a complicated answer, but let me say, first of all, yes, because they tend to listen more, but that's not the only reason. Women have less power than men, and when you have less power, you tend to listen more. That's why women are better negotiators than men. It's why small countries are better than large countries, and it's why children are better negotiators than adults, but they lose that skill when they grow up and get the baseball bat. Because if you have a lot of power, you use that raw power. But it's not a gender thing, it's an environmental thing. Women who work in tough Wall Street environments negotiate just like men. Men who work in softer company environments negotiate just like women. The cultural environment is a much more important indicator of the way you negotiate than gender is.
And by less power, I understand the less power.
That's raw power. Power of
force. You listen because you have to sort of figure out what the strengths and weaknesses are on the other side, rather than just sort of the brute use of emotional or logistical.
Right, and you don't want to cause resentment and retaliation either. And so about 30% of the women in my classes at Wharton and Penn School are women. They get a disproportionately higher share of the highest grades.
That's
and sometimes more than 50% of the class.
Oh, Linda, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Doug from South Bend to join us. And Doug, go ahead, you're on the air.
I've been listening intently to the show, and I'm in the midst of going to India for a negotiation. Hmm. And I've negotiated with our partner a number of times, and I find culturally it's very difficult because their perception of what their needs are, my perception of the needs, seem to be different from a cultural point of view, and I'm wondering how your techniques cross cultural boundaries like
sure.
that.
It's a good question,
I've
Doug.
Spent much time in India. I have taught people in India. Clearly, there are some Indians with different perceptions and some that are not. And so the first thing you want to do, and I'd work through the American embassy, is I'd find people between you and them, cultural interface managers who know both cultures, and I'd find one of those to help me translate. The second thing I would do is I'd try to make sure that we discuss differing perceptions. That's job one, because if you don't, then you're going to get in a lot of communication trouble. Every time you hear something you don't like, you've got to say, are we perceiving things differently?
Hmm. And literally by that, use that phrase.
Yes, are we
meaning do we understand each other?
Exactly right. And you need to find out the different perceptions. And often, there's not a problem. It's just a communication and perception problem.
Right. I mean, we live in this interconnected world. Are the cultural differences, you think, as deep as we think they are?
Deeper.
Deeper.
And that's Mets and Phillies. It's not just Arabs and Jews. What happens is, since the cultural environment you are brought up in affects your personality, the stuff you see so clearly is often not there for the other side at all. Mm-hmm. It never existed. And so this problem is a lot deeper than people think it is. What you see so clearly, it's not there. And so you have to know what's not there for them, because then you know where to start. And that's why there's such a problem with cross-cultural negotiations, including the sales department and the legal department.
About email? I mean, there are all these, you know, the social network ways of communicating, sure, with each other. How do you factor that
the
in?
The problem with emails is no tone. It's like tofu. It takes on the flavor.
Except for those caps, right?
Yeah, but you got to add tone back. Please hear this email as thus and such. You have to make small talk. It's snowy in Wisconsin. What's it like in Philadelphia? You have to read the email as they would read it in their foulest mood. You have to mimic their communication style if you can. But you have to pay exquisite attention to how the other side might react to your email. And I used to write emails at 3 o'clock in the morning. I now don't send them anymore. Because it's...
Because you regret what you sent.
I regret what I sent, right? I want to take a break, look at it again. Every time I've done that, I haven't wanted to send the email.
You spent some time as a journalist, or actually a journalist at the New York Times.
Yes.
Did that, as an interviewer, as a journalist, did that help to inform some of your ideas about negotiation?
A lot. First of all, I used to have to get people's trust in 5 seconds as a journalist. So I'd want to say, what's in their brain? Can I put myself figuratively in their brain? Second, the use of standards is very powerful. The late, great Tim Russert, who was the anchor on Meet the Press, would put up politicians' previous statements and then put up their current statements, and they'd get uncomfortable when they contradicted each other. So looking for people violating service promises, utilities promising service and not giving it to you, then you want to say, well, your website says you do X, how come you're not doing it? And you need to do that in a way not to make yourself the issue. Because when you make yourself the issue and get upset, you lose. Gandhi took away the jewel in the crown from the British Empire without ever raising a weapon and ever raising his voice. Martin Luther King did the same thing with the Civil Rights Movement by simply saying, and yesterday was his birthday, you know, we have certain inalienable rights, and that's a big standard. So when an airline says it's $200 to change your ticket, you need to say, have you ever made any exceptions? What's your standard?
Well, on that note, we've covered a lot of territory. Stuart Diamond, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And his book is called Getting More, How to Negotiate to Achieve Your Goals in the Real World. He's a professor at the Wharton Business School, also with the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org. Member-supported public media.